Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right, welcome into this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer, and I'm joined by Lee Carlo and Jeremy Fisk.
I like how you said welcome in. It's very inviting.
Oh, thank
instead
you.
Instead of just welcome, you're like, welcome in.
Yeah, well, you know, we're an inclusive group. We're trying to bring in as many people as possible. We want to come in, sit down, take a listen, you know.
Warm and inviting.
Yeah, it's like we're around a campfire, you know, warm and inviting. Okay, so on this edition of the podcast, we'll be taking a look at the new film in theaters, Horrible Bosses. We'll then follow that up with a discussion of how jobs in films are shown. You know, that ties into an article that Steve, on one of the writers on Get Your Film Fix, did. And then we're going to transition into a segment called Documentaries Are Movies Too. We'll take a look at a film unfinished. And then we'll go into our top five worst bosses in movie history.
Unless your boss isn't sexually harassing you.
Let's see if this thing's working. Oh! I'm sorry. I'm a squirter, Dale.
You know, yours doesn't sound that bad.
We need to trim some of the fat.
What do you mean by trim the fat?
I want you to fire the fat people. They're lazy and they're slow and they make me sad to look at.
You can start with large Marge.
Marge, can you come in here, please?
What?
You would have to admit our lives would be easier if our bosses weren't alive.
You can fire Professor Xavier.
You mean Hank?
Creeps me out, rolling around all day in a special little secret chair.
I don't care how bad our bosses are. We're not murderers.
Oh, Dale, you know that I like to fool around. This is bad. Bad, bad, bad.
You know what? That's crossing the line.
I'm in.
Okay, so let's do this.
We gotta hire a professional.
I'm gonna be your murder consultant.
Word.
You wanna pull off a brilliant murder? It's gonna look like it's an accident. You gotta be smart.
I'm gonna honk the horn 6 times.
Something much more subtle.
4 honks?
Can you honk once?
People honk once all the time. You're gonna be running in and out of the house.
I'll know what you.
I'll know what you.
Find them vulnerable.
Peanuts? That's a peanut butter sandwich. Are you not good with peanuts?
Whoa, whoa. Look at this.
What about little jabs? Little jabs?
My boss, who we're planning to kill, is dying in front of you and you saved his life?
Well, that sounds bad when you say it like that.
All right, guys. So we saw Horrible Bosses this week, and I don't know if you guys, had the same thoughts, but it seems to me like over the last half decade or so that the raunchy but still has a heart type of comedy has kind of ruled, you know, that Judd Apatow style, really. And just want to know if you guys felt like Horrible Bosses falls into that category as well, or if it missed the mark for you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think it missed the mark, but I didn't think this movie was really a raunchy comedy for if that's the kind of genre we're going to stick it in. I think that it's definitely a comedy. It was edgy. I think the raunchy comedy is defined by at least one kind of gross out scene. Like we talked about with Bridesmaids, it had the vomiting scene at the fitting store. And this one, the closest thing that came to that was when the guy came to piss on him. So I don't really think it was a raunchy comedy, but I don't think that sounded bad because the closest thing came to that was the guy coming to piss. It was fine though. I mean, it wasn't. I'm used to it. I mean, I was cool totally, with it. Yeah, that's the closest though. But I don't think it missed the mark because it wasn't a raunchy comedy by definition. In fact, I think that kind of helped it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think you brought up a really good point, Brantley, as far as Apatow's influence on both comedy in movies and television over the last decade. I think that's a very, very good point, and we are seeing it again here in Horrible Bosses. And it's this sort of comedy where you have a lot of sort of sexually suggestive dialogue and language, but also a lot of wit and relatable and likable characters. And you sort of mesh that together, and that's what you're getting with a lot of these comedies. And what's good about them is they're picking funny and good actors, and that's their strength. This movie wasn't great. This movie had, you know, a half dozen of laugh-out-loud moments. But actors that played these characters are all people I like and I think are funny and can make stuff work. And I'm sure a lot of it was improvisation, and they were having fun. And you could see that in the credits when they showed some outtakes. And, you know, as an audience member, I had fun watching it.
You know, Jeremy, you say this movie wasn't great, and I'm probably going to be harder on it than I should be, but it's because I think this movie could have been so much better. Mostly because I think all the credit is owed to Sudeikis and Day and Bateman and Farrell and Aniston and Spacey, because they were all really funny, and they kind of single-handedly took in kind of an unfunny movie and made it funny.
A predictable movie. A very predictable.
Despite this concept. I thought this was a great concept, that it was really ripe for comedy. But it missed. I think it missed in the storytelling. But it was funny, and I had fun watching it because these guys were all so funny. These guys and gal, I should say, were all really funny. And they took scenes like the pissing scene that I mentioned that was, I felt, wasn't really that smart. It's almost like they couldn't think of anything to do with it, so they just went with that. They're like, oh, we'll just throw this out there. And I thought it kind of sucked as a scene until the guy went to the bathroom and took a piss, and Jason Bateman's like, that was almost all over us.
Yeah,
and I was losing it. It's like, they just saved every part of this movie.
Well, there was a lot of, like, throwaway lines at the end that were probably the funniest lines in the movie. Sort of something somebody casually says as a scene's coming to a close that was really funny. But even with that scene you were talking about, I mean, this is what I mean about this movie being predictable. And you know what the joke is going to be. You knew that guy coming out of the car was not going to be the assassin. Like, you knew that right from the beginning, and there was going to be a mistaken identity and confusion.
Right.
And there was a lot of moments like that. There was a lot of moments where you knew what the joke was. Didn't make it less funny, but it makes... This is the type of movie you watch it once, and you laugh, and you enjoy, and you have fun, but you watch it again, and you're going to be like, well, you know what? This really wasn't that great of a movie. It was sort of clunky. It was sloppily done. And I especially point to the climax scene that just seemed very, very awkward, and they were trying to force a bunch of stuff into this one scene to try and wrap everything up. And I was like, I was almost uncomfortable watching this scene where they recorded one thing and then that didn't work enough, and the police were like, okay, well, I'll listen to this other recording while Kevin Spacey's lying there shot, and everyone's trying
to... The good police.
Bunk. Poor guy. Cannot get another role after The Wire. And he's a much better police in The Wire than he is in this. He's a borderline retarded police in this. And that scene was just so awkward and clunky, and they try to bring everything together in this one sort of situation where everybody's trying to over-explain everything, and it was like the screenwriter or screenwriters were just screaming at us, like, this is how we're going to wrap it up. And it was in those moments, and there was a lot of clunky moments as, you know, as a film in this movie. But I didn't go to this movie to really see a movie that's going to work as a filmic experience. I went to laugh, and I laughed. But that also is sort of a downside to a lot of these comedies we've been ripping on in the last, you know, 5 to 8 years, is that they aren't great films as well as funny comedies.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you in a sense. I mean, I certainly don't go to most comedies looking for, you know, the story, really. You know, I mean, it's almost secondary to me, because what I consider, you know, what I look for most is the laughs and how funny it is. And I do think Horrible Bosses was a fairly funny movie. But I also think some of the things we're talking about in terms of the story that were predictable, I think a lot of it might have just been ruined in the marketing campaign for the film as well. I mean, the whole thing with the, you know, the hitman that they hire and stuff, that was, you know, that's in the trailer. You know, it's like, it's spoiled in the trailer even, you know. And I felt like there was a lot of, that was the way with a few elements in it. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I agree that there's certainly issues with the story, but I guess I'm more inclined to give them a pass to a comedy, because I feel like the laughs are the biggest aspect of the film.
Yeah, I agree, but I don't think they should always, like, we're getting to this point where were just sort of being like, okay, if I laughed and there's this funny moment and these guys delivered certain lines funny, I'll give this movie a pass. But I don't think all these movies should be mutually exclusive from being good films as well as funny movies. Like,
oh, no, I'm not saying that. But, I mean, I'm just saying
it's getting to that point, though, I feel like, where we're just sort of used to the fact that we're gonna get some sort of clever, witty lines, and we're going to get some actors that we all really like, and we're gonna watch it, we're going to enjoy it, but we're not going to expect anything great out of it. And I want to start expecting better things out of these type of movies, a la 40-Year-Old Virgin or, to lesser extent, Knocked Up. Those are the type of things I'm looking for in movies like this, or I used to be looking for when my expectations were a little higher.
I think that this movie, I probably give it more credit than you, Jeremy, for its story, and a little less than you. Well, I mean, Brantley, you just kind of, you know, let that go by the wayside a little bit. But I think that this movie, and specifically Seth Gordon, the director, had the right intentions with a lot of things. Like, I do think he had a hard time kind of balancing all its moving parts. I mean, there were kind of six characters that all had very beneficial aspects to them because of their, you know, characterizations and the fact that the actors are good and that they're funny. But there was never really enough attention, especially given to the bosses. Now, at the same time, I think Gordon was disciplined enough to recognize he has to be careful not to let funny characters get in the way of his story. Like, we learned with Through the Woods with Alex, Jeremy, that, like, yeah, he's a ton of fun to watch. We want to keep him on screen, but there's only so much you can do until you're starting to get away from what you're trying to portray. The problem was that the story was, like you said, it was clunky and it was kind of messy, and they never really seemed like they had a cohesive, structured story that they were really committed to. So in one sense, I give Gordon credit for really kind of focusing in on what he needed to do. I just think he didn't really necessarily have the material with which to do it.
I can see that, and let's talk a little bit about these actors who we all like, but we all have a certain perception of them and their persona and what they bring to comedy, and I certainly don't think they changed that perception on this movie, especially Charlie Day, who ended up turning into Charlie from Always Sunny in Philadelphia by the end. When he started off, it was kind of like, okay, this is a newer, different type of character, you know, a guy who wants to be a husband, maybe a family man.
Which they abandoned.
That's what I'm saying. They ended up abandoning it and literally turned him into Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, all the way to pretending to be a lawyer, learning it from Law and Order. Yeah. And, like, it was almost weird to see. Or he was, there was that scene where he was talking about Danny DeVito. I'm like, that's just meta. So,
they were all like that.
The thing is, though, I don't know if they really ever went away from that. I think the whole movie, he was still Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but he was also still the just-want-to-be-a-husband type of guy.
Yeah, I mean, they kept it there enough so that you could see that he was uncomfortable with Jennifer Aniston's character. But, like, I don't know. I feel like they introduced his fiancée at the beginning and then, like, even brought her in to a scene with Jennifer Aniston, and then, like, that seemed like a different movie by the end. Like, you totally forgot about that character. Just seemed like someone uncomfortable with their boss again.
Oh, I felt like that was more like in the middle of the film. I thought they were just kind of reestablishing his husbandness, or wanting to be a husbandness, like, in the middle of the film, with her coming in.
Well, I thought all three of them were... typecast is not really the right word, but they were all this persona that we've seen before. Like,
well, they were,
I think,
playing to
Jason
their strengths.
Sudeikis, I didn't see Hall Pass, but Jason Sudeikis had, I think, some of the similar dialogue from that I saw in the trailer of Hall Pass and in this movie about how he's like, oh, I'm going to go have sex with that girl over there. I'm pretty sure that line was in Hall Pass, too. And he just seems to be that character. And Jason Bateman kind of plays that deadpan Arrested Development character that we love, but, you know, it's nothing new. I think Colin Farrell, Jennifer Aniston, and to a lesser extent Kevin Spacey deserve credit for kind of playing off type a little bit.
I would say that Colin Farrell and Aniston definitely, but I don't think Kevin Spacey's playing.
No, yeah, Spacey didn't really. But,
well, the weird thing about Spacey was I felt like he was in a different movie. Like, the other Jennifer Aniston and Colin Farrell just were so out there with their portrayals that it was kind of funny. But, like, with Kevin Spacey, I was like, he was, like, played a genuinely horrible person that seemed like he was in the wrong movie because he was so good in a way.
Yeah, he was the least comedic, I guess, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term. I feel like he's more likely to show up on a top 10 villains list than he is on a top 10 comedies in the workplace list. You know
right.
what I mean?
I mean, you could transport his character exactly how he was from this movie to like a gritty Aronofsky movie or something, and
Glengarry Glenn Ross.
Yeah, and there was no difference.
But yeah, Colin Farrell and Jennifer Aniston, especially Colin Farrell, who was, I mean, just by lack of screen time, was somewhat wasted in this movie. You know, he was just great. Like, he was so funny. And
yeah, I wish he was on. I totally agree. I wish we saw more of him. Mm-hmm. He was, the three, he seemed like he was portrayed the least.
Yeah, he was. And, of course, we wish we saw more of Aniston, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It didn't have the greatest story, so all we really wanted was to see more of these characters. So while, yes, Gordon may have been disciplined in not showing too much of them, ultimately he left his audience just wanting more of them because there wasn't a whole lot else to latch onto.
For me.
Don't be foolish, Norma Ray.
Mr. Mason, no one around here is on my side, and I'm not going to leave until I set down all your names on this piece of paper.
Lady, I want you off the premises now. You phone your husband, you come over and tell him to fetch you. I want you out of here right quick.
So obviously Horrible Bosses was about the state of the workplace, and what's interesting about Horrible Bosses is, although their working environment is pretty egregious, this movie isn't about wanting to go and find another job or not have a job and how much work sucks. They actually have a scene in it with a guy who graduated from Yale. I think he worked for Lehman Brothers, and he was struggling to find a job for, I don't know how long it was, 4 years or something. He said he can't even get a wait staff job, and this is when they're debating, well, you know, we could just quit. And that's sort of, that speaks to the times we live in right now, as we all know, in the economy that we're currently having to deal with. You can't just quit your job and hope there's going to be another one out there, because there's not. And Steve's article on getyourfilmfix.com called Remember When Jobs Sucks, or Used to Suck, talks about how in 1999 there were so many movies about how debilitating the workplace and how much it was like a prison between, you know, The Matrix and Fight Club and American Beauty and Office Space. I think essentially we're going to talk about how that change happened and how work has been portrayed in films since the beginning of film.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest difference between what Steve was noticing in those films from 1999, it was in all those films, the characters like, well, I'm sick of my job, or I'm annoyed by it, so I'm just going to quit. As right. You know, it was like as if, you know, people had that option back then. And I think one thing we're kind of starting to get more in this time period, especially in Horrible Bosses, is the fact that people really don't have that option, and that's kind of what the point is, that, you know, what people have to go through just to, you know, make a living, you know, so to speak. And I think it's really just reflecting the time period.
And I agree, and you look at other movies like Up in the Air, it sort of started, and we saw this with the movie The Company Men, which none of us liked, but
yeah.
That whole movie was about being, you know, downsizing or losing your job, and sort of that transitional period in a lot of people's lives. And it is interesting to juxtapose those movies that Steve talks about in his article to movies like Up in the Air, The Company Men, and Horrible Bosses, because it does definitely show a change in our mindset and in our culture about what it is to have a job right now. And I don't want to go on a tangent here, but like coming from our sort of generation where we were told, you know, we could do whatever we want and to be happy and to, you know,
as long as we go to college.
Yeah, as long as we go to college and to strive to, you know, if you're going to get a job, you've got to be happy with it and you don't settle for anything less. And then we find out we're...
So we go out and major in film.
Well, no, it's not only that. It's like that's part of it, yes. We're like, oh, we can, you know, we'll go to college for film and then eventually, hopefully, if everything works out right, we'll be doing a podcast for free. you know, so as we're finding out that we can't just get... We're not too good for every other job out there and we have to go and do a lot of menial jobs right now because of the way the economy is.
It comes down kind of, for me, I think, to just relatability. And, I mean, that's why Up in the Air was being claimed as the movie of the time, because they knew that so many people were losing their jobs and they'd be able to relate to it. And the same thing, I mean, nobody was looking at, you know, The Matrix and Fight Club necessarily as the movie of the time then, but if you look
back... I think they were.
Yeah, but in 1999, I don't think people were being like, yeah, this is what the economy, this is what the job market is like. I think that,
I think it was, because I remember writing a paper on Fight Club right around that time, maybe a couple of years after, and it was a lot about how, you know, it's a stupid college paper on, like, how the workplace is, you know, sucking your soul out, and this is how it's portrayed in Fight Club, and this and that. So I think, I mean, right around that time, people were realizing what those movies were doing.
Well, you're clearly smarter than me, but we knew that. I think American Beauty, if any of those that he brings up, is would have been considered a movie of the time. The Matrix, perhaps only for its technological advancements. But I think you look back on those regardless. You look at them and you say, yeah, that's what it was like then. No wonder people were latching onto those movies. And I think now, because it's just kind of in a state of, or I guess it's worse, just it's worse now for the job market, it's so much easier to look at and be like, yeah, this is the movie of the time, this is what's happening to people, and people are latching on to those movies because it's escapism of some sort. I seems backwards, but it's like, yeah.
No, I think it is escapism, because I think people can go to the theater and look at people who have far worse bosses and have to put up with far worse in their job than they do, and then they can come out thinking, oh, you know, my job's not so bad. So it's definitely...
I was looking at it like you lose your job and then you go and watch Up in the Air and you're like, oh, these people lost their job too, and, you know, that wouldn't help.
I see.
That's relatable.
I'm not sure if it was... Yeah, that's why it's relatable, but that's why I wasn't sure if it's actually escapism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a question for you guys. You know, you look back at let's use American Beauty, for example. Like, you look back at American Beauty, and American Beauty was talking about this sort of materialism and how we work to, you know, and same with Fight Club, work to get things. You know, we're never really free, this and that. Does that, because of the way the job market is now, are those movies still as important? Like, are they still saying something relevant? Can we still take something from them?
I've been saying for a couple of years that American Beauty does not age well, and maybe that's the reason. Maybe it's because it's not really relevant anymore, and like the you know, fine suburban life has kind of been done to death. You know, we've seen it in every movie, and we've seen it in way too many seasons of Weeds, and
right.
Like I think maybe that combined with the fact that it's not really relatable anymore has made that movie age poorly.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously films are going to be most relevant in the time period that they come out, and I think with a film like American Beauty, which, you know, is tackling, like you said, the materialism and having to work for, you know, our consumer culture, and then he gets his freedom when he quits his job, and that's when he feels the happiest, you know.
And works at a fast food place.
And works at a fast food. It doesn't relate in any way, shape, or form to, you know, what is it now? 12 years later.
Right. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying it doesn't relate, but can we is that movie still important in history? Like,
of course, of course.
What it's saying, and can we get something out of it?
Yeah, of course, it's still important, because I mean, it was still a great film when it came out. It's still a great film now.
Well,
the
debatable
message of the film is just what doesn't land as much now. Not anything about the performances or writing or anything like that, or the direction.
I think that time will tell whether or not it's important, because you look at a movie like, and this has nothing to do with jobs or employment, but you look at a movie like The Best Years of Our Lives, and you see, you know, that movie comes out, of course it's relevant, it's about, you know, soldiers coming back from war and what they're received with, and at the time it was important, and then I'm guessing that there was a bit of a lull where that movie was not relevant, but now you kind of get a lot of the same things happening, albeit a different time period. And you look at that movie and you're like, yeah, that movie is important. So maybe 10, 20 years down the road, when, you know, the job market is better and everyone has the luxury of hating their jobs again, maybe people look at American Beauty like, yeah, look at this is an important movie, this is what it's like again, and, you know, it stands the test of time. So, I don't know. I think time will tell. Right now, I don't think that American Beauty is a particularly important movie. I don't think it does anybody any good to look back and be like, oh, wasn't it nice when we hated our jobs? And I think that's kind of the irony of Steve's article as well.
And we can look back even further in film history beyond 1999 and sort of see how things were portrayed even earlier, maybe in the 70s, when there was a lot of sort of factory work. And you look at like a movie like Norma Rae, and when they started developing unions, and or even a movie where it's not featured heavily, like The Deer Hunter, but they were all factory workers back then, and they seemed that, I mean, that was back in the day when, you know, your job was just that. It was your job, and you went to and you did your work, and you could come, you know, you could leave and have a beer and, you know, live. It wasn't as important as we were made to believe growing up, as far as your identity and who you were is connected so heavily to your job. So, I mean, you got movies from the 70s that portrayed that sort of thing in factory work and factory life that we don't really deal with anymore, because most of those jobs went overseas since then. It's interesting to talk about, you know, like Norma Rae, where we're talking about factory workers and the development of unions, which obviously still exist today. And if you want to go back even further, you can talk about a lot of sort of, even Billy Wilder's The Apartment and that work related, and you know, just how he sort of dealt with his day to day life in The Apartment or in Double Indemnity. And
well, in,
you know,
The Apartment, you have him, the way he climbs the corporate ladder,
right?
You know, that stuff I think is definitely something that, you know, and not to go back on this, but that's still something you see in jobs today and in movies today, is that what people will do to get ahead in work related environments.
This is the story of a film that was never completed. A film designed to serve as propaganda for the Third Reich, that empire that knew so well to document its own evil.
Sesam salmim ken raiti bani gas lo evanti ze kedavar mkhuvan aval kamovan sheze kacha.
Mein Film tals noch das Ghetto. Jede Szene wird einregissiert.
Die zu bekommen am mehr natürlichen Effekt haben sie geschossen in die Luften, gedei die Menschen sollen laufen der Schockene.
Documentaries are movies too, just so everybody is aware of that. We occasionally like to pick out a documentary to watch and review. This week we chose A Film Unfinished, a Holocaust-based documentary about basically some found film footage of the Warsaw Ghetto during the early 1940s. Now, watching this movie, guys, I was reminded of the documentary The Bridge, which I'm not sure either of you saw.
I have not.
But it's basically kind of a movie surrounding some footage from hidden cameras of people committing suicide off of the Golden Gate Bridge, and it's combined with testimonies of people left behind, or even people who attempted it or thought about it and things like that. Now, I had high expectations for that movie because it just seemed like a very interesting concept, but really what it ended up being was a documentary about the consequences of suicide. And it really
could have
been... I know
what the consequences of suicide are.
I mean, yeah. The consequences of suicide for the people left behind, I should say. And really, it could have had to do with any type of suicide. Not to be too vulgar or anything, but if someone shot themselves or jumped off a building or, you know, asphyxiated themselves, it would have been the exact same movie. It just happened to surround the Golden Gate Bridge because there's a lot of suicides there. I felt very similar about this movie, A Film Unfinished, because there was very little about it that we hadn't heard of or seen portrayed, at least. And while some of the footage we saw was shocking, it ultimately ended up being a movie about testimonies with people talking about what happened during the Holocaust. And I think had this movie been released 50 years ago, it would have been astonishing. But in 2010, I feel like it's, you know, and this sounds horrible, but I think it's kind of been done to death, and I want to know what you guys thought is on that.
Well, we might edit that and reword your phrasing, but yeah. I agree with you as far as I was waiting for that sort of discovery moment in this movie where the film revealed something about the intent of the filmmakers. And they did absolutely sort of try and go there with these, like, staged... or not staged, but reenacted interviews with the filmmakers. But we never got that sort of, like, moment where we're like, okay, this is what the Nazi propaganda machine was doing, and, like, this is what they were trying to accomplish. Like you said, essentially this movie was just seeing this, you know, obviously horrible, shocking footage, showing it to three survivors who, that must have been tough for them to watch, and sort of listening to them say, yeah, that's what happened, yeah, that's,
and it was a lot of watching it, and it was a lot of watching, like, you know, a Jew on the side of the road sitting there, and then they cut to the testimony and being like, I remember standing there and there was someone leaning against the wall, and then a camera crew got out and filmed it. I'm like, yeah, I know, I just saw that.
Yeah, I was, like I said, I was waiting for this revelatory moment that I don't think really ever came in this movie. Not that this movie wasn't interesting, not that we didn't sort of learn things. I mean, I sort of never knew in the ghetto that there was this distinct, that there was some Jewish people that they weren't well off, but they weren't, you know, starving to death. You sort of see these images where it's just all poverty and people, you know, dying of starvation. But there was a semi-class system within the ghetto, and I didn't really know that. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy, I'm with you as well in terms of waiting for something more to come out of the film, because I honestly think that they set it up that way too.
They set it up as
this is a film that was filmed for propaganda that we know nothing about, and then little by little they would add bits of information about it. You know, oh, we found this we found these interviews, or we found this, you know, this pass for this cameraman to get into the ghetto, or a permit.
That's how they found out who the cameraman was.
Yeah, that's what they said. So it felt like they were adding little bits of information here and there, and then they would somehow reveal it towards the end, you know, tell a story with the film. But it never got to that point. And I would have to agree with you guys that it was just, you know, like watching these images that we've seen so many times before without the completion or the the satisfaction of having seen, like, a story unfold, you know?
I totally agree. And I think the only thing they really sort of had as far as a building block, and as far as, you know, of course they were giving a little bit of information here or there, but really what it was doing was these images were just slowly getting worse and worse and more shocking until the final reel, which, of course, you just see these horrible real images. And you have to sometimes say to yourself, this isn't a movie. These are real images of, you know, dead bodies just being thrown into this mass grave one at a time over and over again. And that's sort of the culmination of this movie. And, you know, you may have to look away at points, but what is that doing as a film? Like, what are we getting from that other than sort of the realization of what happened and the shock value?
Yeah, I mean, I of course was waiting. Well, I wasn't even waiting. I was wishing for that revelatory moment that you guys are talking about, but I knew it wasn't going to come because every time they would bring up that next thing, like Brantley, you were mentioning, they would follow it up with some line saying, "We still don't know what the purpose of this film was or anything." And they mm-hmm. would say it a few times throughout, almost like they were saying, like, "Don't get your hopes up. We're not going to reveal anything too shocking here." Because I think they were relying on the images to be shocking. And at times they were. And, Jeremy, you're absolutely right. I did the same thing. I said, "This is real. Like, wow, this is real footage." Sometimes you have to do that to the point where you kind of also say to yourself, "I hope nothing worse happens here, because I don't want to see that," you know. For me, the most, you know, shocking or, you know, jarring images were when they were showing the multiple takes of things, because that kind of showed you the lack of respect that the Germans had for these people, you know, especially the one they were picking up the dead guy and putting him in a wheelbarrow, and they did two takes of it, and you're kind of just like, wow, that's
a little respect. And I think that's something we can really talk about, especially as filmmakers, because essentially what they were doing was using these sort of real-life horrors as and I'm talking about the Germans here, not the film. They were using these real-life horrors as sort of a stage. They were, like you said, this dead body would fall out of the carriage, and they would have to go and take two, put him back in, you know? So as a filmmaker, I mean, this shows you how sort of propaganda gets manifested in its worst form, I guess.
But I think this film, I think one of the aspects of this film fully embraced is kind of that idea that, you know, in a narrative film, you can say to yourself, if something gets too tough to watch, like say in like Irreversible, right, like, you know, the rape scene gets too tough to watch, we can always kind of say to ourselves, you know, and take a breath and say, you know, it's only a movie, you know, it's not real. And I think with some documentaries, and this one really utilized it, you can't do that. It doesn't allow you that type of escape. Like, you have to, you know, you have to watch what's going on. As long as you're, you know, continuing to watch the film, you don't just shut it off. It doesn't give you that escape outlet, you know. And I think that was at least one aspect that the film did really well, is not letting you kind of escape the horrors of the past.
I don't know if this movie did do that very well, Brantley. Like, I think that we brought something to it in reminding ourselves that this was real footage. This wasn't something that we could just, you know, like you said with Irreversible, like these two actors weren't, you know, friends after this horrible scene. I think we brought that to it, but I don't know if this movie really did that. I don't think it really capitalized on the footage that it had. Like, they were portraying footage from one of the most horrible times in the history of the world, and I never, without my own, like, consciousness saying this is real, I don't think this movie highlighted that very well.
But I don't think needed to. I don't think it needed to go out of its way to go, hey, you're watching something real. Like, I think the images were enough. I mean, what else could it have done?
Yeah, and especially when you get to the end there, and all you're seeing is the, you know, the last reel of the film, and, you know, they're just showing you what's happening without any of their other, you know, intervention, really, with people talking about it or commenting on it. They're just showing you the images, and, like, you have to sit there and kind of take it in.
No, when it really hit me, though, was when they had that little bit of footage that was in color. Because just in our sort of universal consciousness, we see the ghetto in black and white from all the pictures we've ever seen, from all the footage we've ever seen. And this movie has this, like, maybe 3 minutes of the ghetto in color. And that really sort of hit home as far as the reality of it, because I had never seen it.
Like, it makes it feel like less of a movie, yeah.
And I think, not to go back to this because I don't really think there's much of an answer, but I think as a filmmaker, it is interesting to watch this movie because I don't know what we exactly learn about the manipulation of images to an audience, but I know there's something there, especially like you said, with those different takes.
Well, it's interesting because and the takes are the most obvious point, but this movie was clearly edited together.
And staged, and a lot of it is staged.
So it's this movie, A Film Unfinished, is a documentary about documentary footage that was made to be some sort of a narrative. I mean, and if you think about it that way, it's extremely manipulative, and it's very, especially like you said, as filmmakers, it's kind of almost easy to understand how. This is going to make me sound horrible. It's easy to understand how people were buying into it. Like if they,
that's a good point.
You know, they stage something almost seemingly so easily,
right?
They can make it appear however you want.
That's a really good point, and I think that's maybe what I was getting to is exactly as filmmakers, you can sort of see how an audience can buy into what you're portraying as a filmmaker, and you can see how the Germans or the Nazis understood that. They understood what these juxtaposition of images will, how they will affect an audience and how they can manipulate an audience through that, and that's their great propaganda machine, and that's what they were doing, and that's what this film showed you, and that's, to me as a filmmaker, was the most interesting part of this movie. All right, is that time to plug ourselves here at Get Your Film Fix? We want to encourage everyone to surf their way over to getyourfilmfix.com. And instead of telling you to look at the other podcasts and Film Students and our 48-hour Film Fest and all the articles, I'm not going to talk about that this time. I'm only going to say if you're interested, please subscribe to the site. There's a little subscription bar on the right side. You just put your email in there, you'll get our newsletter with all our updates, and you also get every article that we write sent to your email, so you know when we have a new one up. So please, if you could, it would mean a lot. Thanks.
All right, so after watching Horrible Bosses, it's kind of an obvious choice to do a top five on the top five worst movie bosses in film history. So with that in mind, Lee, we'll throw it over to you for your number five and any criteria you might have had.
All right. I guess it's not really criteria as much as it's just kind of a note that while these are my top five horrible bosses, a lot of them, in fact, most of them, are great characters. And, you know, part of me wants to say that they're bad people, they're bad characters, but really they're great characters in some really great movies. But they're horrible bosses, and that has a lot to say about the movie and the actors. So my number five, perhaps the least of that as far as interesting characters go, it is Dabney Coleman playing Franklin Hart in 9 to 5. Movie I probably haven't seen since I was about 10 years old, but I always remember the fact that he was, like, really horrible and sexist.
Even when you were 10?
Yeah, because I was recognizing that? Even then. I was like, wow, he's horrible to these women. How is he saying these things? But they get him back.
It's a movie I haven't seen. It was obviously on a lot of lists for worst bosses, but it's not a movie I've seen.
I can't even tell you if you're missing much, to be honest. I remember it so vaguely, but the parts I remember are just like what a bad boss he was, and I remember something about Dolly Parton.
Our boobs. All right, so my list, the only criteria I had was they had to be actual bosses of legitimate companies. I didn't have like mob bosses or anyone from, you know, the military, a higher ranking in the military. So they were just real bosses from legit companies. And my number five is Lamar Burgess, played by Max Van Sydow in Minority Report.
Ooh, good pick.
He's a bad boss. But that's a little bit of a spoiler, too, if you haven't seen Minority Report. But, yeah. I like
good
that
pick. Good pick. My number five, I kind of – well, first off, I'm calling this my Office Space memorial list.
Yeah, I'm calling it the same.
Yeah. And then – I mean, I don't really have any criteria either, although I think I kind of stuck with essentially what you were saying, Jeremy, that they're all bosses within a company, except for possibly my number five, which is Denzel Washington in Training Day.
Hi. It behooves you not to dick around this one. Justifiable homicide in the line of duty, okay? Now, what happened was...
What happened was murder. And armed robbery. Oh, wait, we have badges, so it's different?
Oh, son, can't open your eyes. Can't you see? Huh?
That man was your friend, and you killed him like a fly.
Come on, my friend, huh?
Yeah.
Tell me why. Because he knows my first name? Son, this is the game I'm playing his ass. That's my job. That's your job. Roger sold dope to kids. The world is a better place without him. Hey, this man was the biggest major violator in Los Angeles.
That's, okay. That's actually a good pick because, I mean, he is on the police force. And
yeah. And he's training Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, he's training. Ethan Hawke's boss. Yeah, that works. That's an interesting pick.
I avoided anything with sort of rank, like a police and military. But, yeah, that's a good pick.
Cool.
All right, yes. Yeah, so now, I didn't avoid the ranking system. I'm kind of glad Brantley broke the seal there for me a little bit. Because my number four is Mark Wahlberg as Digman in The Departed.
Yeah, I was thinking about The Departed, and you could have Jack Nicholson's character, you could have had Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, I did avoid mob bosses, but I did not avoid higher-ranking police officers.
Yeah.
I didn't avoid bad police.
I guess he's a bad boss in the sense of that he never doesn't like do anything to help Leonardo DiCaprio in any of his situations. But then again, at the end of the movie, he sticks up for him.
Yeah, and he's a jerk, though. You know, that's kind of why he's a jerk to everybody.
Yeah.
Regardless of the fact that he's probably doing his job well, he's just a jerk.
I'm the guy that does my job. Who are you? Must be the other guy.
You must be the other guy.
All right, my number four is my most obvious pick. It is Miranda Priestly, played by Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada. I almost left it off the list just because, like Office Space, it was sort of the clear-cut one, but it's my number four.
Yeah, it's definitely another one. It may show up again, spoiler alert, on one of these lists. But my number four, which is also what I thought was kind of sort of an obvious pick, but it was tough to leave him off just because he has such a great speech, is Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross.
A, B, C. A, always, B, B, C, closing. Always be closing. Always be closing. A, I, D, A. Attention, interest, decision, action. Attention. Do I have your attention? Interest. Are you interested? I know you are, because it's fuck or walk. You close or you hit the bricks. Decision. Have you made your decision for Christ? And action. A-I-D-A, get out there. You got the prospects coming in. You think they came in to get out of the rain? A guy don't walk on the lot lest he wants to buy. They're sitting out there waiting to give you their money. Are you going to take it?
I'm going to stay silent on that because I don't like that movie. But
oh, all right. Second place is Knife Set. Third place is You're Fired.
Brantley's doing all the...
Yeah, we're not going to need clips.
No, you're not going to need anything.
All right, my number three is Miranda Priestly, played by Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada. I think that's a really good movie. I always feel a little ashamed that I admit it, but I like that movie a lot.
Let me get this straight, Lee. You just said Glengarry Glen Ross is not a good movie, but then pointed out that Devil Wears Prada is a really good movie.
I did. And I don't like Glengarry Glen Ross. We've had this argument before. I think it's a lot of overacting and a somewhat uninteresting story, despite a pretty interesting concept.
Opposing viewpoints, I can feel it.
Could be.
Yeah, let's do it. You can check out my article, my review of Glengarry Glen Ross on, my 2-star review of Glengarry Glen Ross on getyourfilmfix.com.
There you go. Who's up? Me? Yeah.
You are.
Three. My number three is, okay, well, this is easy. Blake, played by Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross.
Hey, look at that.
Wow.
Okay. All right.
Circle of top fives.
All right, well, keeping in that tradition, my number three is Meryl Streep and The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh, this is the worst top. This is what I was worried about with this top five. This,
yeah, but I think
too many repeats.
I think there's, well, we've all had Meryl Streep and then think Alec Baldwin's repeated, but I don't know if we'll repeat on the rest. We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
All
right, my number two, I feel like I'm going a little bit off the beaten path a little bit here. It is Leland Smith, played by James Cromwell in L.A. Confidential.
Ah, good pick.
All right, another police.
Another police, perhaps. Maybe
bad police.
Spoiling bad police. A little bit. Right, which apparently we do a lot, according to the Exterior Films podcast. They have a bit of an issue with us spoiling things.
Should we have like a spoiler section?
I don't think we try to either. But then they were, I forget what movie they were talking about, but they were saying, we're not going to spoil this movie like the Get Your Film Fix guys
right,
do.
And then eventually they'll like, off it
anyway. Yeah.
Because it's hard to talk about a movie, especially when you're trying to put all the elements together and not talk
They were talking
about
Super
ending.
8, it was and I don't think we spoiled that movie at all. I think they
Well, I mean, we did say that it's an alien and stuff.
That's not spoiling it. You find that out pretty
quick. It's a J.J. Abrams movie. Of course it's an alien.
All right, my number two is Les Grossman, played by Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder.
Colin Farrell from Horrible Boss's brother.
Well, you know, Tom Cruise might have been in was cast in Horrible Bosses, and obviously that's the character he was going to be.
Yeah.
You know, everyone loves that character so much. I mean, I would have liked to see Tom Cruise play him again.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Well, there's like a movie.
It's a brilliant representation of a movie producer, a money-hungry movie producer.
All right. Not
isn't there a Les Grossman movie in production?
There could be.
But I think
it's
there
funny
is.
Because, like, when I, you know, here comes the name dropping. But when I was on Contraband, the location manager said he worked for the producer that Les Grossman is based off of, and he says it's actually pretty accurate. And I'm like, that's scary.
That's so funny, though.
Yeah. All right, my number two is Fred MacMurray in The Apartment.
Man, this is going to be one of those lists.
If you're saying that, then my number one isn't what you have, then.
No, because my number one is what you just had.
I thought about him, while I didn't avoid the Gay Film Fix Top 100 for this list, I kind of just forgot that I was doing that. The Apartment is a movie I just exclude immediately when I'm thinking of top fives. It's shown up on too many for me. It's my favorite. Mm-hmm. I can't continue to stick it at my number one all the time.
Gotcha.
But my number one is Warden Norton, played by Bob Gunn in The Shawshank Redemption.
Ooh, good.
Oh, very good pick.
Didn't even think about it.
Yeah.
Winner.
All right, well, everyone already knows my number one. It is Jeff Sheldrake, played by Fred MacMurray in The Apartment. I mean, he's a horrible boss because, I mean, the only way that C.C. Baxter is going to move up is if he lends out his apartment to his boss to have an affair with a woman that he loves. So that's tough.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
I think you might have been thinking of J.J. Giddies.
I could have.
All right, well, my number one, and in many ways, it's the most obvious pick on my list, but I had a pretty good feeling you guys weren't going to have it on there because I don't think you've seen the movie.
Can I guess?
Oh, yeah, you'll probably be right.
I don't know if I'll be right, but I have a guess.
Okay, go
is
for it.
Is it Ronnie Cox from RoboCop?
No, but that's another really good pick.
That was my honorable mention. But I think
Kevin Spacey from that movie?
Swimming with Sharks? Yeah. Yes, it is. Okay. Kevin Spacey is Buddy Ackerman. Who's another film producer, you know, same with Les Grossman there, in Swimming with Sharks. I mean, he is just the quintessential, just evil boss. Although I think Kevin Spacey outdid himself with in Horrible Bosses in terms of the lengths to which the evil boss goes.
My fucking coffee.
Buddy Ackerman's office. Can you please hold?
Cream, sugar?
Sweet and low.
Come on, people. I'm late for a meeting here. Let's go, 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 go.
But he's pretty terrible in Swimming with Sharks.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. But yeah, I thought you were going to have RoboCop on your list, which is why I left it off for an honorable mention for me.
Nah, but that's a, like I said, that's a great pick, man. I wasn't even thinking that.
All right, there you have it. Not our best top five, but you know, we every once in a while
I really liked Minority Report. That was a good pick.
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We encourage you to check out the site, getyourfilmfix.com. Check out our other podcasts, videos, all of our articles on there, as well as if you'd like to go to iTunes, give us a rating, a little review. We always appreciate that. And if you're inclined, we do have a donate tab on our site that helps us keep doing what we're doing. So if you want to throw a little money our way, we would certainly appreciate it. All of it, 100% of it, goes towards the website and the podcast and the videos we do and just keeping everything going, because we're not making any money off of it, and it certainly doesn't generate any money now. So anything you can do really helps us out. So thanks, everybody, for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
Why won't Jennifer Aniston just show her tits?
Oh, I know, huh?
Like, I mean, at this point, just show them. I've seen most everything except for the nipples.